We might get underway, and some people will still drift in from downstairs as we do introductions, so I think that's fine. Thank you all so much for coming to this session. So this is about case studies, actuaries, and public policy. So real pleasure to sort of chair this session. I think most members of the Institute sort of appreciate that that actuaries and the Institute do a fair amount in the space of public policy, but I think also maybe they don't really appreciate just the scale at which that happens. So if you do go to the new Institute website, works quite well, and you click through to the submissions section, you'll see there's about 200 submissions over the last 10 years that the Institute has made to different government inquiries and sort of departments and so forth. So that's sort of one every couple of weeks. And that's just a lot of work from volunteers and from the public policy team. Vanessa's here, who leads that very, very ably. So there's a huge role that we have sort of contributing in that way. I also serve on the public policy committee at the Institute. And one good thing we get to see there is just the huge amount of thought leadership that also gets produced by the department, by the Institute. So there's a list for this year, which is about 15 to 20 different thought pieces. Again, one coming out every few weeks. Which is just an amazing sort of volume of work contributing to that public policy debate publicly. And then perhaps most excitingly for me, actuaries are also taking on this role where they are directly contributing to public policy, either because they've got jobs where they do that day to day, or whether they're consulting, advising government departments. So it's not an official practice area yet. Maybe one day it'll be there. But actuaries in a variety of ways are making quite a big contribution. So that's my opening ramble. Today's session is to aim to highlight some of these things that are going on. We're very lucky to have an excellent panel to talk through four different experiences of contributing to public policy. Hopefully this session will be a mix of sort of informative and inspiring, so everyone else in the room can do a lot more of that stuff in the future as well. I've got some opening questions that I'll sort of lead off, and I'll introduce the panel sort of as we go. If you do have questions, please submit them in the app or on the microphone. Microphone might be fun if you want, but we'll try and make sure there's some genuine sort of opportunity for questions as well. So with that out of the way, we might start with you, Charanjit. So Charanjit Padam co-leads the Perils and Climate Practice at Finity, where he provides advice to insurers, government, and business on all things climate. His work has been recognised widely. So he was ANZIF Insurance Leader of the Year 2022, Actuary of the Year from the Institute 2023, and is also a TEDx speaker, which is probably the best one. Which one's the best one?
Obviously the Actuary.
Okay, well said. Party line. All right. So most importantly for today's session, though, Charanjit has co-authored a series of reports looking on the topic of home insurance affordability and related work on perils and climate risk. So thanks for being with us today, Charanjit. Your work on Home Affordability Index has had enormous cut through. So why do you think the work has been so impactful and how have you found the experience?
Thank you for that introduction, Hugh. I think I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Like, I mean, this is something that, general insurers in particular, but lots of people have been talking about for a long time about the impact of climate on home insurance affordability going forward. We've been sounding the alarm on this for what feels like decades. So I think it was the particular that there is this idea talked about in public policy circles of like the Overton window, right? And of having there is a very limited window of time following events that government and policy is able to change. And the nature of policy change is often nothing, 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 massive change, nothing, 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 massive change, right? And so being the right person at the right time is really important. And I think that we'd started to do the work, the work that the papers I wrote were really a culmination of many papers that the Institute has written over many years about this issue. I stood on the shoulder of giants, but the takeoff and cut through was because it was the right information at the right time to the right people, which is very hard to engineer. Like, I mean, and I do, I think it was just luck, right, for that one. We had a kind of confluence of events where we were starting to see climate change impacts. We were starting to see insurance prices really go up and being raised in a number of forums. We also saw insurers much more willing to talk about it. We saw the key public policy bodies like APRA, ASIC, and the RBA start to talk about it. And so because it then had a place to land, it worked well. The other thing I will say to it was, again, the great work done by Vanessa and the Institute team, which is those papers weren't just written and then put out there. We had a sequence of engagements with suitable bodies, including the aforementioned government bodies, but also ACOS and others in terms of civil society, to get feedback on what we were about to do and ask them what would be useful for you. And so that's what we did. Yeah.
Fantastic. And do you think there was anything in the way your findings were presented, or sort of the role of sort of sound bites and things like that in cut through? Or
yes, I also think we spent a lot of time figuring out exactly how we can present this information, right? And you know, the notion of the index, which in the beginning I was a bit, oh gosh, not another index. Like, how many indices do we actuaries have to produce? Like, you know, but it has cut through in a way that I guess, you know, in hindsight, because it's quotable, it's a single number that describes and encapsulates a problem. A bit like that metric you were talking about, the GAN things yesterday. No, it's a single metric that kind of encapsulates the whole problem and what's going on. And that was very important, because it's a complex issue that we were able to turn into a single number, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that number tells a math. Well, it's a curve really, but it tells the whole story behind it. And so when we presented it, we spent a lot of time thinking about what is the narrative and the story, and how do we use that data to illustrate that story? Again, through lots of coaching from the Institute and, you know, what we do is what we do best when we do it well as actuaries. That was the point. Yeah.
Thank you so much. If I move on to Melanie. So Melanie Dunn is with us today. She's head of actuarial services at Accurium, where she leads the actuarial consulting and superannuation teams. She's a recognized expert in SMSF advice. I don't know whether to say the acronym or just self-managed super. She's part of the Institute's Super and Investments Practice Committee and chairs the subcommittee on self-managed super, as well as being chair of the Self-Managed Super Association Tasmanian chapter. And
that's enough.
That's it. That's right. Not actuary of the year yet. The yet's important. All right. And Tasmanian actuaries, can I get a cheer from the Tasmanian actuaries in the audience?
Yes. Come on, there are a couple here.
All right. So, Melanie, you bring a wealth of experience for self-managed super, and you had the opportunity to apply that knowledge with an Institute submission recently. I was wondering if you could give a description of the recent advice you gave and the issues you were trying to solve in that process.
Yeah, thanks, Hugh. Thanks for that. So we're kind of stepping from the big picture that we just talked about and the opportunities there to a submission that was very technical, very niche. You know, we're talking superannuation, SMSF, and this submission was in respect to legacy pensions in a self-managed super fund. So even more niche in terms of the expertise we were bringing to the table. But this was an example of a submission that, although it affected a small number of Australians, it was meaningful to them in a very real way. And this submission provides and is continuing to provide opportunity to help those Australians. So this submission was a very welcome surprise. The draft regulations late last year that government introduced, and the SMSF subcommittee was given the task to respond to that submission with the Institute. And what this submission was all about, or what the draft regulations were proposing, was allowing the full commutation of a legacy pension, so a defined benefit pension or a market link pension in a self-managed super fund over a period of 5 years. And they also introduced or proposed a change to reserve allocation rules in a self-managed super fund to allow allocations to count against a member's non-concessional contribution cap instead of a concessional contribution cap, as well as allow allocations of reserves to pensioners who were still alive but previously had one of these expired or ceased complying pensions. Now, some of that probably went over some people's heads in terms of the technicalities of these particular income streams in a self-managed super fund. And it is true, these pensions are, I'd say, not very well understood outside those actuaries who work in self-managed super funds. Both advisors and indeed the pensioners who hold these pensions sometimes misunderstand their benefits and how they're entitled. And this has led to a number of problems as we approached these regulations. And there was a budget promise that was made many years ago that these regulations welcomely proposed to implement. So the issues that were there that we found these regulations really important to assist with is first that point of the misunderstanding of these products and how they're communicated to members. They're not well understood, particularly the capital access. So these are a bit like a traditional defined benefit pension, and you can't start these pensions anymore. They really are true legacy products in a self-managed super fund. The member would give up their entitlement to an amount of capital, and actuary would have said is how much you need to fund a pension liability to the trustee, who is themselves in a self-managed super fund, and that would sit in a reserve to fund the pension liability. And the member's only entitlement really is that pension payment each year. But that is not well understood, and this is partly because of the the dwindling nature of these products and professionals who are dealing with them, but also the accounting systems that produce member statements. Often these attribute the reserve to the member. So when the member sees what money they've got, they think they've got $500,000 that will be available to them. And even more importantly for their kids, that would be payable to their kids in the event of their death. But that is simply not the case. And that's led to a lot of issues when people pass away thinking, oh, can I have mum and dad's $500,000, please? No, you cannot access that. And there's a lot of problems for how to deal with that reserve in terms of subject to that $30,000 concessional contribution cap, trying to get that out of the fund when members pass away. These reserves can be hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars. So essentially we've got a position where people are stuck with a self-managed super fund that they may not want or be appropriate for them, but they need to maintain that to allocate these reserves, or they need to maintain it because these income streams are non-commutable. So while the pensioner is alive, you can't just stop that pension and pay the money out or roll it to an account-based pension, for example. Further, all these pensioners are aging. They're all in their mid to late 80s. So we're really getting to the pointy end of having to deal with these products. And so these regulations were very welcome because we've got pensions that you can't commute, don't pay a death benefit, people don't understand, and they're stuck in self-managed super funds that are not appropriate for their circumstances. Further, there's complex valuations under the transfer balance cap and total super balance and dealing with those reserves when people die. So really complicated kind of advice situation and not a lot of options. So, you know, when we saw these draft regulations overall, I think the committee and industry more generally were very happy and very pleased with what Treasury put forward. We would be pretty happy if they went through as is, but there were a number of technical considerations that we felt important to raise as part of the process. And we were fortunate to meet with the ATO and Treasury as part of this. So we worked closely with the SMSF Association. A number of our committee members, along with the association, got to meet with Treasury and discuss the technicalities of this submission. So that was really valuable, having that insight into what they meant and what they intended the draft regulations to do. We worked with also other stakeholders within the Institute. Although this submission was primarily focused on self-managed super funds, we liaised with the Life Insurance Committee and the Superannuation Committee more generally to make sure that any concerns or issues around how this legislation might impact the broader superannuation and kind of defined benefit world were addressed. And we put forward, 8 considerations. The main two were encouraging government to get it done as soon as possible. There's a lot of angst in the advice industry around Division 296 and the valuations of these complying pensions and what that would mean for restructuring advice in advance of the implementation of that. And Social Security implications. A lot of these are assets test exempt, those of the smaller side. And when you commute one of these pensions, you lose your assets test exemption, but government also incurs a 5-year clawback of age pension entitlements you would have otherwise received if that capital was not assets test exempt. Now, that's a fairly material sum of money for some people. And we saw this a lot during the GFC, and the government or Social Security introduced debt waivers that allow for that debt to be waived and not incurred. But they're very specific, and a key point we put forward in this submission was to ensure that debt waivers were introduced so that there were not unintended consequences for people complying with these new regulations from a Social Security perspective. So they were actually introduced and regulated from the 7th of December. So they took our advice on that and did it promptly. And because they're regulations, they are law from that time. There's a disallowance period, but we expect bipartisan support, and advisors are already taking action to help clients exit these products. So a really pleasing outcome for this submission.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't know what people complain about when they say super's too complex, but actuaries adding value on stuff where the detail really matters is really, really cool. So how was your experience working with the Institute and that process of trying to make practical advice to government?
Yeah, I think it's great that we have so much expertise and knowledge as actuaries and on the committees across the Institute. And I find these submission processes just so valuable to learn what you don't know or what you might not expect, other issues and problems that you maybe hadn't thought of, and how you can think strategically of that impact to influence the policy and influence government. So I think that's really key for me. And in terms of a practical perspective, I'm someone who strives for practical outcomes for perfection. And I think when we're dealing with government, I like to stand in their shoes and kind of think about why are they putting this policy forward? What's their motivations? Because it's all well and good if we have a view of policy B is the ideal, and that's where we want direction to go. And that's what we have our policy position papers with the Institute to help kind of propose those ideals and where policy should move. But when we're looking at individual submissions on a specific policy the government wants to implement, it's important we think practically about still proposing that maybe that's the best outcome. But if they don't want to move to that scenario, what change can we propose in a practical way to what they've put forward that we think is realistic for them to improve, so we can move the dial to make progress towards that goal of kind of that ideal policy position?
Yeah, thank you so much, Melanie. Laura, I'll ask you a question. So Laura Dixie is a director at Taylor Fry, specialising in government practice. I also work at Taylor Fry, so the real question is whether she can surprise me today. So she does a variety of research and evaluation projects across quite a broad range of government work, so including health, disability, social sectors. So recent projects would include community pharmacy agreement evaluation, linked homelessness pathways, mental health treatments in emergency departments, as well as defining outcome measures for children, particularly those with disability. So Laura, you've worked with dozens of government departments in delivering advice, and that spans from policy right through to sort of detailed quantitative research. So how have you found working in these areas that most actuaries would regard as very non-traditional?
Firstly, just to jump on that non-traditional, I think if you look over the lifetime of the profession of actuaries, absolutely it's non-traditional. And particularly some of the work or the projects I've been involved in have been looking at long-term pathways through government service use and the fiscal costs associated with that, and essentially building up a liability or a claims management. And that is, I think, quite directly linked to actuarial. It's quite obvious. But actually, the other kinds of projects we do are less directly linked. So, like you say, looking at outcomes of community pharmacy programs, housing programs, looking at homelessness needs for support. And so those are less directly linked, but there's still that core of quantitative analysis, using data, trying to use it well, often attaching fiscal benefits and taking quite a long-term lens. So I do think it's non-traditional, but I really enjoy it. I think it's very rewarding, and the opportunity to improve services, which actually influences everyone, because government services are so broad. And that kind of comes through two avenues. So there's the scale of government services and the areas that they're operating in. I think sometimes it's easy to be like, oh, the government does welfare and tax and manages the health system. But actually, when you get into it, there are so many services and programs that the government is running. We've looked at housing programs that are actually all about improving people's employment and education outcomes. Like you say, looking at services and emergency departments, and all of these have like distinct settings, and often you can't set and forget. So for example, we've looked at when the rental market kind of crashes, what happens to private rental subsidies and how do you keep sustainable outcomes for people? And again, the breadth, we've also modelled occupational shortages. And so that starts to affect not just vulnerable people when they're interacting with government services, but actually everyone. So the government has large levers in migration, has large levers in education. So I guess that's all just to say that the scale of programs that the government is running is huge, and the population that it affects is everyone. And trying to use data well to inform those programs is a real opportunity for actuaries, I think. Across all these projects, we see like a real range of maturity in terms of using data to inform evidence, to check we're getting the outcomes we want to get. Government app and data is quite awesome. It doesn't always tell you exactly what you want to know, but it covers these really large populations. You've got a really long time series. And some of that comes into, if any of you were at G and Tom's talk yesterday on causal modeling and data fusion. So there's these assets sitting there, and they can be used to inform really good policy and to make sure when we're spending government money, it is efficient, which in our current kind of economy is important. Currently, it's not always used or not used consistently. There is barriers to that. So there's skill set, there's data governance, there's sharing, there's resourcing. And so I think there's a real opportunity for actuaries in that we're quite well suited to coming to new problems, understanding the context, understanding what's available, and designing a solution based on data to try and inform what the government's trying to achieve there. So yeah, I really enjoy it.
Fantastic. And are there any trends or changes over time you think about how governments work and how they're using data?
Yes, definitely. I think the use has increased. The desire to use has definitely increased. I think it's consistently seen to be really valuable and everyone would like to be doing it. But the reality is there's barriers. And so that level of maturity of doing so and actually using it to influence policy and getting the timing right so that the evidence is coming in before you need to make changes to policy, that's where there's struggles at the moment. And that's kind of where I think we're actually quite well suited to help.
Cool. And so last but not least, certainly, is Pulkit. So Pulkit Jain has worked as an actuary in general insurance for about 15 years. He began in consulting on natural hazard pricing and has worked as a lead actuary at a Lloyd's syndicate and has worked at AIG. But more recently, he's spent the last 3 years at the Australian Reinsurance Pool Corporation as head of actuarial. So he's done a lot of work with the ARPC over that time and shepherded through much of the rollout of the Cyclone Insurance Pool, which I think in the practice question I'd wrote flood, which is maybe getting ahead of ourselves. But the ARPC is now like almost an integral part of the insurance landscape basically overnight. So Pulkit, of the panelists here today, you're the only one with a .gov email address. So rub that one in. But how have you found that transition from corporate to public sector? What does working for a Commonwealth entity enable you to do? What things are annoying? All that sort of stuff. No annoyances.
I think 3 years in, I think I'm still making that transition a little bit. I think the biggest part for me has been the mindset shift of I spend a lot of time working in general insurance pricing, chasing kind of the holy grail of profitable growth as the target objective, and you're making decisions to try and achieve that. To shifting the mindset to in the public policy space, trying to make decisions with the public benefit, specifically in the cyclone pool, around improving insurance affordability and accessibility. So a lot of the metrics that you're used to looking at and focusing on, like your combined operating ratio, are viewed very differently in this space. You're not thinking about quarterly or annual profit cycles. You're trying to make decisions, thinking about the long-term cost-benefit analysis, and it is quite a big mindset shift. I think I constantly am, one of the questions I keep finding myself asking myself is, when making decisions and setting assumptions, is have I actually removed all the conservatism or margins that I might typically bake into this kind of assumption setting, and thought about it from that public policy environment, given the different objectives? I think one example of that is the pool provides discounts or reinsurance premium discounts for policies that have undertaken property level mitigation activities. So if you've tied down your roof, for example, you get a reinsurance premium discount on our cyclone reinsurance premium. We have to make that decision based on thinking about the best available information we have and the fact that in the legislation we've got an objective to incentivize risk mitigation. Whereas in the private sector, typically you might think about waiting till you've got the data to feed it through your models, and your models are showing that you're reducing your risk to a level that you might adjust your premiums. But it's kind of a different decision-making point, I think, in the government with a different objective. In terms of enablers, I think certainly the ability to make an impact across the broader insurance industry. So I think the obvious one being that we've got some legislative power to make influence across a range of insurance stakeholders and to achieve the objectives of the scheme. Working within government, you also get the opportunity to collaborate with other government departments, work directly with Treasury. So you see how other parts of government are working and working collaboratively to achieve a goal. And also, unfortunately and not fortunately, had the opportunity to be part of the parliamentary inquiry process, which can be quite daunting, but it is an important process that kind of helps set the direction of public policy. I think some restrictions or grievances. I mean, the obvious one that I think people talk about is you're there to achieve a public good. So there's going to be more public scrutiny. So there is a greater level of governance and process that comes with any decision making. I haven't found that to be overly onerous, if I'm honest. I think maybe the part that I have run against the most is coming from maybe a consulting background where you sometimes have a bit more freedom to explore different areas. You need to be very careful where you're spending your time and resource in government to make sure it's kind of within your remit, within your mandate, and any time and money you're spending ultimately translates to policyholder premium. So you need to make sure you're staying within your mandates.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. All right, so do get questions in, and if you want to stand up at the mic, if you want to ask in person, that's fine too. In the absence of that, I'm just going to go rogue and ask lots and lots of questions, so it could get wild. But Charanjit, maybe starting with you, how important do you think it is that the index comes from the Actuaries Institute as opposed to the Insurance Council of Australia or the Council of Aggrieved Homeowners or something? So,
thanks. Yeah, look, I think that was a big consideration in what we were doing in putting that paper out, in that, you know, we as a profession, we have this thing about being unbiased or being kind of true to the data and sticking with that. And we are often in a position of trust. And that was part of our brand and part of what we wanted to emphasize, right? So I think that's also partly why we had so much cut through with what we did. The stakeholders out there do see us as independent or not necessarily with a profit motive when we're giving these advice, right? And there's lots of people wanting to advise governments and giving them lots of ideas and studies that that perhaps are not disinterested parties, right? So I think that is important, but I think there's a kind of counter to that where and it was really interesting when you were talking about, you know, this is the best policy but this is the practical one, right? But I do also think that, you know, we do have to have a view, right? I think there's some things out there. We're not the ABS. We're not just publishing stats that could be useful for other people. These are policy positions that are asking for change, right? And in that sense, we're not independent. Like, you know, we're not. And we need to be honest and open about that in those interactions. Like, these are the goals we're trying to seek for society and what we're doing. I think you did a great job there talking about, you know, talking about efficient use of funds, right? And are we doing this in the most efficient solution? And they're all set out in our policy principles. And I think that's, that, you know, I worry sometimes that we try to portray ourselves as too independent, you know, it's sort of like very disinterested parties just kind of giving you numbers and you do with it what you like. And I don't think that's the right approach.
Yeah, cool. That's a question.
Thank you. Fantastic presentation, everyone. Labor has said that it wants to use consultants less and beef up the public services ability. And I was wondering if you're seeing any move either that the Australian, you know, government department is really being beefed up, or within Treasury, are they on a recruitment drive for actuaries? Or do you think government understands the value that actuaries can add here?
Yeah, great question. Laura, did you want to crack?
Sure. I haven't seen large recruitment drives, but what I have really seen is a desire for handover. So I work in consulting, all of our projects are done, and there's a real focus, I think, at the moment on, okay, but how are you upskilling our team in the process? How are we going to be able to do this once you guys have done it once? As a consultant, I'm kind of excited about that because I like doing stuff the first time. I'm very happy for people to take over the running of it from there. I think there's some challenges. I think you see public servants move around a little bit more within roles, like quite naturally. So the continuity of team isn't always there. So over the course of a project, the team will change and you kind of lose that knowledge transfer that you've already done. The value, I think they value the skill set of sort of quantitative analysis. I haven't seen a specific actuarial focus on it. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll just add the comment that obviously there are some government-employed actuaries in the room, and so they do a lot of good work at the risk of offending them. The other comment was that actuaries often have quite a specialised skill set. So sometimes when they talk about less, spending less on consultants, often that's the policy development side, which sort of rightly government should say that should be driven in-house rather than sort of being farmed out. So to the extent that we have that specialisation, that sort of means that the effect is maybe not as profound.
Hi. Actuaries have prescribed roles. Those roles are perhaps getting less. Actuaries are involved other places. The public policy that we present, how do we make sure that we aren't seen as self-serving? How do we make sure that we promote actuaries for good, as opposed to actuaries because we're actuaries?
Very good. I don't know, who wants to first go, Melanie?
Yeah, good question. And I'd say superannuation, our sector is a really good example of that, where the statutory roles for actuaries are kind of reducing, you know, traditional defined benefit pensions. And we have actuaries working in superannuation in all sorts of roles, boards, management, product, technical, insurance, research, consulting. So I think the value we bring that I see with actuaries, particularly in superannuation, is just the breadth and experience of our knowledge. When we're putting forward policy or submission, we have such a wide perspective, and we can have, and I've experienced this, you know, really healthy debate internally about what are the right trade-offs and positions when we're creating something like a public policy position paper. We're working on the retirement one at the moment, and I think, you know, that breadth of knowledge and experience means that we create something that's really comprehensive and well thought through, and we can give reasons why we're putting policy positions forward. So I'm pretty excited. I love superannuation and retirement, so everyone should move into that sector. But I think, you know, for me, although that's not, you don't need a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries to have this role, the fact that our skills bring this diversity of thought and analytical combined with problem solving and decision-making puts us in really good stead to hopefully provide really valuable insights to government, and therefore they'll keep looking for actuaries to provide that quality advice.
Good one.
I was just going to kind of echo some of those thoughts. I think my experience since being in government has been there is a lot of value on advice provided by actuaries, not just when it's from a statutory role or not just from it's from a role where it's prescribed. It's I think when making public policy decisions, people are very hungry for information or looking for relevant insights that are recent and cut through, and stuff that comes from actuaries is highly valued.
I guess I'm going to answer this from more of my practice in working in climate change, for example, where people, like I often don't mention I'm an actuary when I'm doing that work. I think there's one thing we have to be very careful about is that while the actuary has a brand and has things associated with it, the real important thing is actually demonstrating it in the work that we do, as opposed to, you know, show, don't tell is my view on that. So they often, you know, when I have happy clients, they're amazed at what we do because they had no idea that was possible and now it was done. Mm. But I won't kind of sit there and say, I'm an actuary, so I know how to do this stuff. Because often that they don't know how to relate to that. They don't know what that means. But if you show it with your actual work, then I think that's the truism to it. And I think actually that's a really important thing. Like, you know, I came from the UK when there was no statutory role for actuaries in general insurance, right? And many of my colleagues in the UK at that time loved it because they said, you know, we've got to compete against everybody else. We've got to be sharper. We've got to be better. And that was their mindset to it. And I think we kind of can't move away from that mindset. We have to continually demonstrate in what we do that it is of value and it's not just an accumulation of a title or a reserved role.
Mm. Very good. Question?
Just wanted to ask, given that some of the themes you're discussing are global in nature, like even superannuation, the underlying themes are still global, does the Institute do anything to try and influence global debate on those themes, maybe even partnering with other institutes around the world?
On the climate side, yes. So there is the International Actuarial Association, and they have I think it's Climate and Sustainability Committee now. And we have a lot of Australian actuaries who are very active on that and doing that. And I understand that's the case with many Australian actuaries being involved in the work of the IAA. Only do that if you like waking up in the middle of the night and having, you know, like, I if you love your sleep, it's not a recommended role, but, you know, I'm sure that it's other people.
Yeah. I think it's probably also data science is another area where, like, the coordination with the other institutes has been quite interesting because they've seen actuaries in Australia sort of lead the charge a little bit into that space. So they've sort of certainly been asking the Institute people sort of how we've done it, which I'm not sure necessarily we've got a good answer to, but we are doing it, which is good. Question.
Thanks, Hugh. Sorry, I'm just take a different view for approach from Tim's question. Is actually, should we not be pushing our own self-regulatory environment? I mean, traditionally the actuaries were set up because there was a hole in regulation. Okay, so to make sure that financial institutions remain solvent, they had to set up their own professional body. And the initial debate in the 19th century was that we would do it better than government. Now, in super particularly, we've got 20,000 pages of regulation, most of which is impossible to understand and difficult to reconcile. We do have a problem that we don't have the regulation. We're over-regulated by people who, as Laura's pointed out, are inadequately trained because they move around. I think there's a huge, I'd like to suggest there's a huge role for actuaries in proposing that self-regulation should be used more frequently. And I just like the response of your
back to that. Very good. Melanie, do you want to take on the amount of regulation in super?
I don't really know, Anthony. I agree that in superannuation, you know, there's a lot of opinions and a lot of change. I think one of the questions Hugh was going to ask me was, will we see continued change in superannuation? And to that, I kind of giggle and say, when government says there'll be no change to super, we all just go, uh-huh, and wait for the next one. So I know that, you know, actuaries in various capacities are doing lots of work of how superannuation policy could be better considered, what self-regulation would look like. That's kind of a new concept to me, kind of how that would work. But I think the more actuaries with our breadth of knowledge and understanding can help guide government and aid government in creating good policy to the benefit of all Australians and their financial outcomes is a good thing. How we do that, obviously with the current way we do submissions and our policy position papers, and Aidan and Vanessa and the team have, you know, great management of our public policy positions. We just have to continue to drive that. I'd be interested in hearing more about your thoughts, but it's not an area I have great insight to be able to advise you on, Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind in your question is two things. One is what happened in APRA's post-HIH changes in general insurance, where effectively PS300, as it was known at that time, was copied and pasted into APRA's GPS something or whatever. I've lost track with those areas. But and I thought that was a very interesting thing, because it perhaps, you know, in a small way, where the profession didn't provide the support for HIH not going insolvent, which is a long and I don't want to spend too much time in that black hole about whether we did or whether we didn't, but it was the government reaction, which was to then take away some of that control we had about how exactly insurers should reserve, right? General insurers should reserve. So I think we have to be very careful about that, because the other example that springs to mind is what happened in the UK, where even professional standards were stripped from the UK Institute and following Equitable Life. And, you know, and now they have the accountants supervising the actuaries in the UK, right? Which, you know, at least we still have our professional standards and we find ways to make them work. But I guess, you know, we have to be very careful with that. And I don't think we always have a history of always being perfect, like we have failed. So I'm not sure whether the private sector does it better than the public sector. And in the end, I would want the public to have the strongest protections possible, which does mean regulation, in my view.
Yeah, cool. Question for you, Pulkit. So this is going back a long time. Whenever I chatted to someone about sort of should you have flood reinsurance in government programs or cyclone insurance, often you get back sort of a very sort of detailed two-sided argument about yes, it'll do wonderful things, no, create sort of wrong incentives and so forth. I guess you're in the position where you actually have to drive through decisions and design and actually sort of make it happen. What have you learnt about sort of actually making stuff happen compared to sort of at the risk of stereotyping actuaries sometimes equivocating? So.
I think I mentioned that one of the challenges or the restrictions was that we've got a very clear mandate and we have to kind of stay within that mandate. I think the flip side of it is we've got a very clear mandate and we know exactly what we need to do. So there were deliberations prior to the pool being set up, and there's deliberations during the implementation phase, and there continues to be deliberations now. But I think working at the ARPC, we know that it's clear in the legislation that we're there to implement the pool. It's got set objectives. I think those deliberations are a good thing. The pool is designed to have a broad impact. There's lots of stakeholders that often have varying views on how the pool should operate. But ultimately they're mostly trying to think about what the best outcome for the policyholders would be. So I think in our role or my role, it's important to be cognizant of those views and understand the different stakeholder groups and their sensitivities. But ultimately for us, it's relatively clear what how to kind of drive forward and what our objectives are.
Mm. Yeah, cool. Question
also. Really good presentation, guys. Really enjoyed it. A question for any of you. I guess I have recently observed in recent years a minimization, a pushback against experts of any sort in favor of like the loudest voice on social media. As you presented in your various forums, is that something you've come across or is that just still an American thing and we thank God are safe.
I don't know. I mean, when you're saying presenting, like if I'm talking to financial advisors and that type of community and clients who are, you know, seeking views about superannuation, that is one space I think financial influences can have an impact potentially to detriment of outcomes. And we really talk to our clients being accountants and advisors about making sure they're the trusted advisor and informing clients that things that look too good to be true are probably too good to be true. In the self-managed super fund space, this is particularly prevalent around accessing superannuation, using properties in funds. There's a lot of noise out there that can influence people's outcomes because, you know, they think, wow, this is my path to achieving the financial freedom that I want. This advisor or this company is telling me to do something. I'll do it, but it can be very severe consequences. So I think certainly in the SMSF space, the ATO as the regulator definitely has this type of thing front of mind. So in our sector, it is, it's not a prevalent problem, but it is something to be aware of and that we try to, you know, educate our clients about.
Yeah, look, I work in climate change and there's definitely lots of misinformation and vested interests out there. So, I do think that, a large part of what we're trying to do is show the value and, you know, going back to that thing about the data piece. So one thing that the Institute started doing, many years ago, which was the Australian Actuaries Climate Index, which I think is an excellent thing because it just shows the data and shows the reality that climate extremes are getting worse in Australia. And it's just there. There's no modeling. It's just the data that's there. What was interesting about that was when it was first done, some scientists got very annoyed with us doing it. And I think it's partly because they hadn't thought of doing it themselves and they were annoyed about that, right? Because again, like the best type of actuarial analysis is we consider the range of complexity, but we simplify the decision making at the end of it, right? That there was a clear a lot of the climate scientists struggled with some of this because people demanded certainty. And certainly the influencers can be, can come up and be very certain in what they're doing. Whereas the reality is much more nuanced and science plays in that nuanced area. And it was very hard for them to then shape a narrative that was giving a very clear information. And I think we're better able to do that. The best actuarial work, puts insights and decisions and, as well as the raw data. So I do think we do have to carry on doing that piece and fighting misinformation and that part. I think the areas that we also tread in and, you know, we make choices. The Institute does make choices about which areas we want to provide submissions on and where are we going to be valued and where we're not. And, you know, we don't want to put out a response to everything. We have to kind of choose our space and play very well in it. And one of the things that we have got is we are experts worth listening to, position in government. And we have to protect that by, you know, that is the most valuable thing we have. And we need to protect it religiously as we go forward. In practical terms, I did a TEDx talk and I think part of what I like to do is make things exciting and interesting. Some people say I talk very passionately about things. But, you know, so I often will write my report and then it'll go to the Institute and come back. And we just had to tone it down a little bit here, Sharanjit, which is like the constant feedback I get. And I take that because it is important that we have that measured tone because that's part of what achieves our brand. And, it is, important that we are not too flowery in our language and our approach. Because that's how experts stay valued. And I think the Institute does a great job at that.
I look forward to getting that feedback from the Institute one day. two questions on the chat. I might direct them to Laura, and they're related. So the first one is, what opportunities exist for early career actuaries to become involved in policy work, and how they can best position themselves? And the second one is, any suggestions on how actuaries can demonstrate value to encourage more public service roles? So how do you get involved in the space?
Good question. I think there's lots of avenues. Basically taking an interest in the types of projects. I can't speak for working at kind of a private company, but certainly in consulting there tend to be lots of project opportunities. And through the Institute, there is a lot happening in the public policy space, and just starting to get awareness of the conversations that happen, the people that are working in the space, what they're thinking about. I would encourage you to get involved early, because I think it's a really good way to learn, because there are so many different projects, each one with a different project, different like context and different solution that's needed. And it's often quite iterative. Which is a really good skill to learn early, that you need to iterate and refine rather than sort of really nailing something down to perfection. What was the second part?
Well, it's sort of related. So how to demonstrate value to encourage more public service roles. So.
It comes back to, I think we've already had the discussion about providing really high quality, insightful work, when we are in that role. So really demonstrating that value, making sure clients value it. I think trying to get it out there. So pushing for sharing of results is a really useful thing. We don't need to duplicate work across departments. And I think particularly if you come back to being sort of anyone can take the skills that are quite useful of listening. So the context varies. Government have a really, like Paul said, they have a clear remit. They know their area really well. We might bring great data skills, and knowledge of that, but we really need to listen to understand their context and read as well, to try and get that understanding. And then just being willing to adapt. I mean, it's all projects, but I think it's a bit exaggerated in public policy. That the context changes, the strategy changes, the stakeholders expand, and you just need to be able to adapt to that and be a little bit flexible.
Yeah, great answer. And at the risk of exposing the panel, like, we do submissions, we do thought leadership, we do consulting, we work in government. There are lots of avenues, and hopefully the panel's done a little bit of that today. I think I can hear tinking of lunch. Maybe 30 seconds each. Just to finish off, what's one thing that gives you hope about public policy or you find encouraging about public policy? And then we can sort of wrap it up.
Great. I've already got the mic. there is a push at the moment in government, both state, territory and federal, for evaluation. So really getting clear on measuring outcomes that the government is achieving. I think that's awesome. It's going to really encourage data use. I think the push at the Commonwealth level with the retained government will be good for that particular avenue, a bit of consistency there. And then when we embed it on that side, which is kind of looking at, once we've got a program or a policy in place, how is that working? It naturally leads to getting data and evidence embedded earlier, because you'll start to think, well, if we're measuring these outcomes and we're accountable for those outcomes, we need to start looking at them earlier. So that excites me.
I would say just the quality of our profession and the continued breadth of roles and experience that our people have means that we're in a really good position to continue to provide that really holistic viewpoint and advice. So we can continue to be valued in what we put forward for public policy.
Not biased working in the public sector, but I think I think the quality or the calibre of people, I shouldn't say surprised, but I think I have been very impressed by the people in the panel today, but even people at Treasury or the Australian Government Actuary, the quality and the passion and the motivation of the people working on these problems has been quite inspiring.
Yeah, one thing I just wanted to tag on to that previous question that I was asked about, how do actuaries get involved? One thing I will say, the way that you shouldn't do it is come in with arrogance about being an actuary, right? And I think this sits with this, the what you were saying about the listening skills. Because if you want to do wider fields and you want to be involved in public policy, you have to go into a lot of humility and understand that the people you're working with are the experts in their field. You may have something useful, but you can't go in and say, oh, this will be actuary, so it'll be the best, right? And I have seen that done very badly, you know. So I just want to tag that on. And in line with that, I think also what I'm really, really kind of seeing in the way that, say, policy around resilience and that thing is being done in government is much more in a partnership way, recognizing that we're going to pay for things anyway, and the argument is about an equitable division of those costs, right? So things like the hazards insurance partnership, where government is sitting down with insurers and trying to solve things that way. And I think that that's part of what we need to all recognize, that if for many of these public policy issues, it's collaboration and accepting the problem and then working across everyone affected to develop solutions, that is the right way to go. And I'm seeing that kind of thinking a lot more.
Yeah, cool. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the panel as much as I have. Can you please put your hands together for a fantastic session? I'm sure they'll be around for the rest of the day. Thank you for your questions too. Go enjoy some lunch.